sponsored on in dealing with some of these matters, to pick up specifically when we deal with their respective partners. We have in our presence this afternoon, as I've indicated, the Honourable Deputy Minister of COGTA, Honourable Andries Nel. We also have the Honourable Deputy Minister of Economic Development, Honourable Masuka. And then there is a number of supporting staff. Some of them who used to be honourable, I know they haven't become dishonourable in the process, I doubt so. But welcome back to Parliament, Mr. Lohoro. I see you're used to sitting on the right, so you're still on the right. That's a good, I don't know, Honourable Masuka, is that a good or bad thing of sitting on the right and thinking on the left? But well, welcome back, and we look forward to the presentation. And it's one of a number of interactions that we are having with Parliament, members of Parliament, parliamentary committees, and also some of the other structures at the more collective level. I hope more members will join us so that they can also have insight in what is being presented here. Over to you, Honourable Deputy Minister, and you may introduce your delegation that is coming here.
Thank you very, very much, House Chair and Honourable Members, and thank you very, very much for the opportunity of having this interaction. I'm joined by Deputy Minister Madala Masuku of the Economic Development, who's a part of the Integrated Urban Development Framework Steering Committee. There are a number of other Deputy Ministers who are part of that. We'll speak to that a bit later on. I'm also joined by the Deputy Director General for many things, local government support, integrated urban development, etc., Mr. Temba Fossi, as well as Dr. Christian Olver, who's recently joined us as a program manager on the IUDF, and Ms. Sheila Hughes, who's the Chief Director dealing with intergovernmental relations. Chairperson, our presentation will cover three broad areas. Firstly, we will give a broad overview of urbanization and apartheid spatial patterns and the policy instruments that have been put in place to deal with those issues. Secondly, Mr. Fossi will give a brief update on the progress that we've made in implementing the IUDF. And lastly, I'll come back to what we would want Parliament to assist us with. I think first point to make is that integrated urban development framework is not a COGTA issue. It's a whole of government and a whole of society issue. And on the screen you can see that this policy was developed by Human Settlements, National Treasury, Economic Development, Transport, Environmental Affairs, together with South African Cities Network, and I'm sorry I omitted to introduce Mr. Stole Mbanga, the CEO of the South African Cities Network, and also SALGA. These are the areas that we will be covering. I think the first point to make is that the world is urbanizing extremely rapidly. What you see on your presentation and on the screen is a photograph of the globe at night. And the areas of electricity indicate your major urban areas. It also paints a picture of which parts of the world are already urbanizing and which are undergoing that process. This is a picture that shows the concentration of mega cities, large, medium, and smaller cities throughout the world. Very significantly, in 2010, the world reached the so-called urban tipping point. It was the first time in history where there were more people living in urban areas than in rural areas. By 2050, it's projected that 70% of people globally will be living in urban areas, rural 30%. This is just a quick, I don't know if someone can just dim the lights. On the screen there, you'll see a representation of how the world has urbanized over the past 5,000, 6,000 years. You see, around 2,800 years before Christ, there in the Middle East, slowly cities start emerging. Those who know the Bible well will know those ancient biblical cities. Then cities start spreading from the Middle East to India. Then on the African continent, cities start emerging. I think that's important to note. Very often people don't recognize that Africa was actually started developing cities long, long, long before Europe. Then you'll see there the cities in China start emerging on the right-hand side. Then your first European cities start emerging about 1,000 years before Christ. Also significantly, cities start emerging in Central America, your Aztecs. If you just look, at the moment still, urbanization is still occurring mainly in the Mediterranean, India, China. Now cities start spreading to Western Europe. At 100 AD, the pace is starting to pick up, and that urbanization is starting to accelerate more and more and more in Europe. We're coming to the end of the Roman Empire. Islam is starting to spread, and you can see we're entering the Middle Ages. Slowly, and cities are just springing up more and more and more. But also significantly, as you can see on the African continent, more and more cities are also starting to spring up. This is the age of European colonization is starting. You can see cities starting to spring up in North and South America. In the 1700s, the 1800s, you can see things are really, really picking up. 1900. But what happened after 1950 and up to now? I think the point there is that urbanization is a historic megatrend. It's something that really defines the era that we live in. About 1.5 million people are added to the global urban population every week. Significantly, 90% of the urbanization that will take place between now and 2050 will be in Africa and Asia. By 2050, most of the world's urban population will be concentrated in Asia, 52%, Africa, 21%. That represents 2.5 billion people that will be added to the urban population. Just to give you a perspective from China, when China adopted their new type urbanization plan for 2014 to 2020, what they were saying was that domestic demand is the fundamental impetus for China's development. And the greatest potential for expanding domestic demand lies in urbanization. So the Chinese have put urbanization at the very, very heart of their national development plan and their economic strategy. Premier Li Keqiang said in 2015 that the practice of human development indicates that industrialization and urbanization are twin brothers of modernization. China's urbanization levels have increased from 17.92% in 1978 to 54% in 2014. The Chinese referred to adopting a more people-orientated new style of urbanization. And they say they have to resolve 3 100 million people tasks. Firstly, to enable 100 million migrant workers, farm workers, to settle down in cities and become real urban residents by 2020, accelerate the urbanization process of the central and the western regions, guiding 100 million farmers to enter the towns and the cities nearby, and to concentrate on rebuilding rundown areas and unsafe buildings and cities to solve the housing problem of more than 100 million people. So if we think we have tasks, it should give us some perspective. Overall, there is a correlation between human development and urbanization, so a rising human development index in more urbanized areas. Key cities are key to alleviating poverty, creating wealth, fueling growth. 55% of the global population live in cities, but those cities are responsible for more than 80% of the global GDP. Also on the African continent, there's generally a correlation between GDP per capita and urbanization. But if you look at that chart carefully, you'll see it's not absolute. There are countries with very high levels of urbanization that are in fact quite poor. What's significant also is that it's your middleweight cities in emerging markets that are poised to deliver nearly 40% of global economic growth by 2025. And if you look carefully at that chart, you'll see that it's not necessarily just your big metro, but your small and medium-sized cities that are going to contribute massively to economic growth. The challenges of urbanization, those are the good things about urbanization, but if we don't do urbanization right, the challenges are environmental, that it impacts directly on nature conservation and natural habitats. Unemployment in cities often is very high. Urban poverty, the concentration of poverty in very dense areas, that can lead to increased criminal activity, it can destroy the fabric of society, it can have a negative impact on heritage and culture, can cause congestion and overcrowding, can also give rise to increased costs of living. The big challenge that we have is to coordinate urban development and rural development. We need urban and rural, not urban versus rural. And this is a key point for the IUDF. We talk not of urban areas versus rural areas, but of an urban-rural continuum. And you'll see that spelled out in that graphic. It demonstrates that we have, it's not a stark difference between an urban area and a rural area, but those areas have a continuum. The next slide indicates all of the linkages between urban areas and rural areas. Nature, people, food, money, ideas, and how they often circulate between urban areas and rural areas, but how also some of those factors constitute so-called push factors that push people from rural areas and into urban areas. The point, though, is just that we need strong rural, developed rural areas to support strong, well-functioning cities, and we need strong, well-functioning urban areas to support viable, sustainable rural areas. South Africa, the point needs to be stressed that when we talk about urbanization and urban areas, we're not talking only about metros. We're talking about a very wide range of areas, and it gives us a breakdown there that out of our municipalities, 95 could be classified urban, 16 urban towns, 45 urban villages, 49 mixed, and 8 could be classified as rural municipalities. The point is that many areas that generally are regarded as rural are in fact have very strong urban characteristics. So if you look at an area like Bushbuck Ridge, that most people would regard as rural, in fact has more people and a higher population density than Mogale City in Gauteng, which most people would regard as an urban area. The next slide indicates that there's densification taking place throughout the country. So if you look at those areas that fall under traditional authorities, that are generally regarded as rural, those areas are undergoing extremely rapid development and densification. If you look at a municipality, a metro, like Itegwini, there are in fact big, big, big parts of Itegwini that are in fact very rural. On the other hand, you go to areas that are generally regarded as rural, they're becoming extremely dense. So when we talk about IUDF, we're not talking about metros. We're talking about dealing with the totality of urbanization in South Africa. Second part there is dealing with urbanization and migration in South Africa. 63% of South Africans are already living in urban areas. This will rise to 71% by 2030. By 2050, 8 out of every 10 South Africans will be living in an urban area. And I stress, an urban area does not mean a metro. That's going to place massive demand on basic infrastructure requirements. And we need to plan for that. The next slide just indicates on a province-by-province basis, which provinces are losing population is decreasing and which provinces population is increasing. In Gauteng, I think over the past 5 years, something like 1 million people have been added to the population of Gauteng. I mean, that's the equivalent of the whole of the Northern Cape moving to Gauteng. So the point also is that about 30% of Gauteng migrants are from outside of South Africa. So that's another reality that we need to deal with. That slide just illustrates what we've been saying, and it breaks it down into the different categories of municipalities. Next slide is just giving a list of some of the fastest growing areas. And I think what's important there is to say that you have many, many municipalities apart from the metros that are actually undergoing extremely, if not faster, rates of growth. The next slide there just gives a breakdown of a wide range of municipalities classified according to high, medium, and low urban population, and also the different growth rates. Next slide makes the point that our municipalities have different capacities, both financial, technical, and political, to deal with the reality of urbanization. And this, I think, makes the point that there's a very strong link between implementing the Integrated Urban Development Framework and implementing the Back to Basics program. Then we come to the very, very important issue of dealing with the legacy of apartheid spatial planning. The slide there demonstrates what was the apartheid grand master plan. All of those areas in color represent the different homelands. The red lines there indicate how people were forcibly removed into those homeland areas. That was the macro apartheid spatial plan. If you look at the next slide, which indicates the index of multiple deprivation mapped geographically, those areas in dark blue represent the poorest and most deprived areas. They coincide almost exactly with the previous slide that indicates the old homelands. The challenge also is that if you look at the slide on the left, it's 2001. You look at the map on the right, it's 2011. It just indicates that when it comes to dealing with the spatial inequality of apartheid, our progress is very, very slow. This indicates the model for your typical apartheid town, divided into white group area, African group area, Indian colored group area, township, Indian CBD, white CBD, etc., industrial. And the reality is that many, many of our cities and towns still bear the marks of this apartheid spatial planning, characterized by group areas and forced removals, etc. The spatial challenges in South Africa are spatial injustice, the spatial unsustainability, lack of spatial quality, spatial inefficiencies, lack of spatial resilience, need to increase the state's capability. The factors that are perpetuating these spatial patterns are four. Firstly, continued segregated urban settlements. Secondly, unequal income levels and access to services. Thirdly, unsustainable infrastructure networks and consumption patterns. And fourthly, existing property markets and land use. So when it comes to continued segregated urban settlements, we see there a map of Cape Town. And it's mapped according to, it's taking the census and mapping it according to race. Whites are pinkish, Indians are green, colors are amber, and Africans are blue. I mean, that just indicates how segregated a city like Cape Town is. And it's not unique to Cape Town, of course. The same would apply to Johannesburg. And, I mean, we could show slides of virtually any city in South Africa and it would demonstrate similar patterns. That is a geographic representation of languages in Gauteng. And just see how geographically separate people from different language groups live. When it comes to socially isolated wards and gated communities, this slide tells us that it's not just on a macro level, but even on a micro level, our living spaces are extremely isolated and fragmented. Secondly, unequal income levels and access to services. That's a map of Gauteng. The areas that are red, yellow, amber are the poorer areas. The richer areas are greener and darker greener. So again, there you see your Sandton is dark green, your surrounding areas. So even income levels are distributed according to space. The next just is a very graphic representation of spatial inequality. A golf course and the informal settlement side by side. The third area is unsustainable infrastructure networks and consumption patterns. Those two slides show in 2001 where the core of Johannesburg was. Johannesburg has grown, but if you see most of the growth represented by the dark brown areas actually falls outside of that core area. So our areas are sprawling. The next is a little video clip that shows the development of Johannesburg from 1900. Look what happens from around 1970, 1980 onwards. Existing property markets and land use. And I want to spend a bit of time on this slide, and at the same time welcome the Deputy Minister of Transport, who has made a huge effort to come back to this session. We welcome her, especially in October, which is both Transport Month as well as Cities Month. Just on this slide, the blue dots indicate the planned housing developments. The red dots indicate the number of businesses per square kilometre. And the grey dots indicate the unemployment dot density. Now, you see there where unemployed people are living, where businesses are, and where we are planning housing is not in sync. So in a sense, we're perpetuating some of those spatial inequalities and problems. The next three slides deal with the question of land, and urban land in particular. I mean, it makes the point that South Africa's population is actually concentrated in 2% of the land. Under 10% of South Africa's population live in very low-density areas, or 97% of the land. 83% of South Africa's population live in medium to high-density settlements on only 2% of the land. So urban land is extremely valuable and scarce. And we've got to address, when we talk about addressing the land question, very often people tend to think about rural land and farms. I think there's a strong argument to be made that the urban land question is as, if not more, pressing than the rural land question. Not to play the two off against each other, but just to emphasize the importance of the urban land question. Then also there's a strong link between urbanization and infrastructure. I'm not going to dwell on the details of this. I think Minister Patel touched upon these issues yesterday in the PICC presentation. But just to say that urbanization is leading to massive backlogs in urbanization. More than 375,000 new households are added to cities each year. That has huge implications for housing, for water, electricity, and sanitation infrastructure that we need to plan for. Then, how do we, that's stating the problem. The issue is how do we deal with that? The policy framework is firstly the UN Sustainable Development Goals that were adopted in 2015. Very significantly, for the first time, we included a goal on urbanization. So SDG 11 talks about making cities and human settlements inclusive, safe, resilient, and sustainable. Based on that SDG 11, UN Habitat at the end of 2016 adopted the New Urban Agenda. New Urban Agenda seeks to implement that SDG and develops a policy framework and a plan for implementation. On the African continent, we adopted African Union Agenda 2063, and that talks about cities and other settlements being hubs of cultural and economic activities with modernized infrastructure and people having access to affordable and decent housing, etc., etc. South Africa's own national development plan devotes an entire chapter 8, to integrated human settlement and transforming the national space economy. It makes the point that since 1994, densities have increased in some urban areas, and there's been partial regeneration of inner cities coupled with the growth of housing ownership, but overall little progress has been made in reversing apartheid spatial geography. In fact, elsewhere in the NDP, the point is made that some of our human settlements and infrastructural programs, good as they are, as proud as we can be of them, and in fact, in global terms, some of those programs have been phenomenally successful. But in terms of spatial transformation, they've actually, in some instances, entrenched apartheid spatial patterns, and we've got to give very concerted attention to reversing those. Now, the NDP calls for the development of a national spatial development framework based on spatial justice, spatial sustainability, spatial resilience, spatial quality, and spatial efficiency. The NDP commits us as a nation to, by 2030, ensuring that South Africa should observe meaningful and measurable progress in reviving rural areas and creating more functionally integrated, balanced, and vibrant urban settlements. For that to happen, we must clarify and relentlessly pursue a national vision for spatial development. Secondly, we've got to sharpen the instruments for achieving that vision. And thirdly, we've got to develop the capabilities in the state and among citizens. So the Integrated Urban Development Framework that was adopted by Cabinet in April of 2016 seeks to give effect to that chapter of the NDP. It sets out the principles, the policies and programs to achieve the NDP's goal of transforming the national space economy. The IUDF's overall outcome is spatial transformation. We say that it marks a new deal for South Africa's cities and towns, and it seeks to steer urban growth towards sustainable growth model of compact, connected and coordinated cities and towns. The IUDF aims to achieve a set of complementary goals. Firstly, as we said, that vision is livable, safe, resource-efficient cities and towns that are socially integrated, economically inclusive, globally competitive, where residents actively participate in urban life. The strategic goals are inclusion and access, inclusive growth, effective governance, and spatial integration. There are 9 IUDF policy levers. The first and almost foundational one is integrated planning and management. And we'll come back to that one. Secondly, integrated transport and mobility, integrated and sustainable human settlements, integrated urban infrastructure, efficient land governance and management, inclusive economic development, empowered, active communities, effective urban governance, and sustainable finances. The cross-cutting priorities, and I think this is very important, would be to strengthen urban-rural linkages, to ensure urban safety, and also urban resilience. Urban resilience meaning that if one looks at what's happened in the past few days, in terms of the floods in Gauteng and KZN, that we should design our cities in ways that also deal effectively with climate change and other natural disasters. Really what we're seeking to do is to unlock that urban dividend by coordinated investments in people, the economy, and in space. Now, at the heart of all of that is integrated planning and spatial alignment and collaboration. We there give an overview of South Africa's planning framework, starting at an international level with the SDGs, the AU 2063, the NDP and the National Spatial Development Framework, all your national sectoral plans. Then at a provincial level, your different planning instruments, and at a local level, your IDPs, your built environment improvement plans, your municipal spatial development framework, etc. The reality is that there's a basically good planning architecture, but that planning system often doesn't work in the way that it's meant to work. And we're going to come back because we think that you as parliamentary committees have a very important role to play in helping us get that right. COGTA, together with the South African Cities Network and the CSIR, did a study some time ago around integrated planning and development. They took a number of different, a representative cross-section of cities and towns and studied their planning and implementation. basically what they found was that spatial alignment is critical and must prioritize and target government investment initiatives and projects to address priority issues within specific areas. Secondly, that merely having multiple projects within the same geographic area will in and of itself not enable government to significantly impact development priorities and spatial transformation. And thirdly, that bringing about desired spatial and developmental outcomes requires strategic selection, prioritization and coordination of interventions in time and space between different role players and institutions, including the private sector and civil society. So given South Africa's planning system, constitutional and multi-sphere context, this kind of outcomes-oriented spatial alignment of government intervention should require, firstly, integration between different functional sectors or line departments within specific localities, but also between sectors and institutions at regional and national scales, i.e. horizontal alignment. Secondly, strategic alignment across the different spatial scales, thus between integrated and strategic spatial plans of the different spheres of government, i.e. vertical alignment. And thirdly, active guidance for spatial alignment and outcomes of the different role players within specific places through municipal IDPs and SDAs. Now, honourable members, just to put some reality to that technical speech, what that means in practice is that, look, as government, we've progressed in the sense that through our policies and our planning mechanisms, we are able to identify priorities for certain areas. We've prioritized the 27 poorest district municipalities. We can say, we can determine at a national level what the broad priorities for those areas would be. The challenge is that very often, having come together to determine those priorities, we still retreat into our silos to go and plan, and we plan in a silo way, so that you can say that a given area needs 10 schools over the next 5 years. It needs 20,000 electricity connections, 30,000 water connections, 10 kilometers of roads, or whatever. The challenge is that that package isn't delivered in a consistent, collaborative, coordinated way. You're going to end up with the schools being built in year one, but only getting water in year two, electricity in year three, a road leading to the school in year four, and the province appointing teachers in year five. Now, I mean, you might think that I'm exaggerating, but when we went to visit Lusikisiki as part of the presidential Siyashola visit a few months ago, I mean, we were taken to a beautiful, brand new police station that had been standing idle for 3 years because the station is there, the station has electricity, the station has water, but the station isn't connected to bulk sanitation. So it just illustrates that importance of integrated planning and implementation, because very often if one element is missing, a whole infrastructural investment grounds to a halt. So I'll now hand over to DDG Themba Fossey just to give us an overview of the implementation, of progress with implementing the IUDF, and then I'll come back to what we would ask committees to assist us with. Thanks.
Thanks, Deputy Minister. Thanks, Chair and Honourable Members. As the Deputy Minister has indicated, the Integrated Urban Development Framework is not a co-opted program, but it's an all-of-government approach. So from the inception of this framework, the whole development process was guided by this political steering committee. So we have been inclusive from the beginning to ensure that all of government finds expression in shaping the actual framework. That political steering committee continues to meet regularly to guide the whole implementation of the program. In recognition of the urban-rural continuum, as part of our intervention, there are three areas, key sort of focus areas that we're looking at. The first area is a program that is led by Treasury, the city support program, which is largely focusing on the 9 metros. There's a lot of work already that has been done in terms of ensuring that special plans of national sector departments are linked to the expenditure plans of municipalities. And this has assisted in terms of fostering the integration in these metros. We've just completed now the fourth round of these built environment performance plans. So we'll be continuing to update and review how we strengthen the whole alignment. Part of the other work that we're doing with Treasury is to look at different instruments where metropolitan municipalities can tap into funding from capital markets, not just dependence on the grants that they receive from the fiscals. Also engaging with the development finance institution to ensure that we're able to assist municipalities in terms of municipal debt instruments and reforming the whole development charges that municipalities charge for infrastructure costs to developers. There's a whole urbanization review process that is currently underway, looking at the long-term patterns and trends. The other second area is looking at the intermediate cities, which are sometimes referred to as secondary cities. We're fortunate to be supported by the Swiss and the World Bank in terms of this program. We will be starting with the two pilots, Umhlathuzi and Polokwane, just to test the methodology and the new grant mechanism in terms of supporting the secondary cities. The last area is the small town regeneration program. This is championed by SALGA, but involving all the key departments. There's already a project that is underway in the Karoo region, which involves about four provinces that are also centrally involved in terms of ensuring that and the Department of Rural Development also is assisting in terms of promulgating a special development framework for this region, including other departments that are involved, such as tourism and science and technology. We're also supported by the Department of Rural Development, looking at the local special development plans of municipalities to ensure that we're able to provide a basis for aligning special plans of the three spheres of government and integration at the municipal level. As COTA, we are in the process of reviewing and updating the IDP guidelines to ensure that also that intergovernmental alignment is able to assist in terms of fostering that integration. We, as part of the work that we're doing in supporting the secondary or intermediate cities, we are reviewing the whole grant framework, which will be piloting in the two secondary cities, Polokwane and Umhlathuzi. We'll be using the creating a window in the MIG, Municipal Infrastructure Grant, to ensure that there's a particular focus on spatial alignment and integration. And the idea going forward is to ensure that all your grants that are focused on achieving spatial transformation outcomes are consolidated and then be able to get that integration. Treasury and COCTA are also reviewing the reporting reforms. One of the challenges is that municipalities are overburdened by different reporting requirements from national, provincial sector departments, and this assists in terms of rationalizing and ensuring that there's a streamlined way of reporting. DPME has recently concluded an evaluation of the human settlement, which confirms the good work that has been done, but there are remaining issues that relate to spatial fragmentation, lack of integration of delivery of services, and failure to create those active secondary market and housing assets. They are in the process of developing a human settlement white paper, which will respond and address some of these issues. Also, they need to address some of the key issues relating to accelerating the informal settlement upgrade and mechanisms to finance housing. They have recently held a human settlement summit where many of these challenges were discussed, but also a new approach of ensuring that the new urban agenda is localized and then also in the context of driving the South African Urban Development Strategy, which is the IUDM.
Thank you very much. I think just some issues that we would want to put on the agenda of this meeting and other structures in Parliament is that firstly we would want to suggest that parliamentary committees use the IUDF as a framework for interrogating the urban impact of those departments that account and agencies that account to them in terms of their programs and their budgets. Second issue, the key issue is the alignment of public and private investment around clear spatial priorities, i.e. economic nodes, integration zones in each municipality. I think it's very, very important that when it comes to issues of managing urbanization, reversing apartheid spatial patterns, we can't only look at government. We've got to look at the private sector, how the private sector, the banks, the developers, etc., are investing money, how they are going about their own development. And in very many cases, they're pursuing profit over achieving those social objectives. And we need to find ways that government can work with the private sector, but also, where necessary, provide a regulatory framework and also provide, well, both incentives but also disincentives for the private sector to behave in certain ways. Third point would be that there are key issues for promoting alignment in the urban environment. Firstly, spatial impact of programs, the intergovernmental relations processes that are followed, the impact across the urban-rural continuum, the fiscal mechanisms and the infrastructure grants, the monitoring and the evaluation of the impact of those programs, and the ways of involving other stakeholders in the private sector. Fourth point would be if committees could structure questions in ways that push departments towards greater alignment and cooperation. Because very often what happens, I mean, through the portfolio committee system, you're engaging with one department. But the work of that department is linked to the work of so many other departments. So how does Parliament structure its own work to take account of that reality? Some of the issues that we thought that could be asked of departments would be, has the department looked at how the department's projects and programs contribute to the implementation of the IUDF? Does the department have an impact across the whole urban-rural continuum, from metros to secondary cities to small towns to dense rural settlements? I.e. that we develop and we heighten that consciousness of space, both amongst members of parliament but also within departments. Thirdly, do the department's projects and programs support urban densification and access by the most poor and marginalized to urban jobs and services? Fourth, are the department's projects and spending aligned with local spatial development frameworks and IDPs. Very, very often, we find that national and provincial departments enter the municipal space in an uncoordinated way that's not aligned with IDPs and local plans. And we then end up with infrastructure for which there's no clear maintenance plan. We end up with infrastructure that's not aligned with other work. Again, we end up with bottlenecks in delivery. The first point is, what intergovernmental relations mechanisms does the department use for ensuring alignment of municipal, provincial, and national activities and strategies? And sixth, how does the department monitor and assess its impact on urban development? Now, those are fairly broad questions. And House Chair, I mean, we would want to commit ourselves that if, either as a collective of committees or individual portfolio committees, you would want a further engagement with officials from the IUDF Steering Committee to help refine these questions, to make them more specific to your own portfolio or clusters, we would gladly assist you in that regard. So, Chair, that we thank you very, very much for this opportunity. We would welcome a further engagement in the form of questions, but we would welcome it even more if we could have suggestions and if we could have a discussion about the role that Parliament and parliamentary committees could play in this regard. And I think that should not just be restricted to the National Assembly. I think it's very important that the NCOP also be part of the process. And of course, much of this would relate to the work of parliamentary committees in your oversight work in terms of hearings and engagements with departments, but also the many oversight visits that you play to different areas. And I think also in terms of the constituency work that many members of parliament engage in, I think it would be a very important area, and we would welcome it if in the context of your constituency work you want to ask us to assist in promoting these issues. Thanks.
No, thank you, Honourable Deputy Minister. I will now open up for questions or comments from members of Parliament that are present here. Honourable Fultaga.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks for the enlightening presentation. I'm so glad that we have this opportunity to engage with the departments, you know, at this level, instead of just a single question in Pali, and then it's done. At least now we can move forward. Because when we engage with the department in that kind of environment, it's almost like it's perceived to be confrontational. Yet that is not exactly where we want to be sometimes. I have a disbelief that South Africa, if it were to begin to think out of the box, can actually develop counter strategies to counter the urbanization, which you have said is a global trend. And in fact, we have got a stronger reason to do so than anybody else, especially given what you have told us about the population figures in Johannesburg, that a good percentage, close to 30%, you know, people from elsewhere. If we don't tackle it and we just want to be ready to go with the flow, then we are landed for trouble. And the reason I say so is because land is not stretching. There isn't much land, you know, for urbanization. And the standards of building in urban areas are different from the standards of building in rural areas. And so it becomes very, very costly. And we may not have the budget to do so. So my question, therefore, with that the premise is that how can we slow down the urbanization trend in South Africa? let's allow ourselves as governments to feel challenged, so to do, we need to. I have heard the economic reasons that prompt urbanization. Have you checked what are the psychological reasons why people are constantly drifting to the cities? Not the social ones, which are like having films around, nice things all around you, economic ones are clear, but the psychological reasons, because that's where the real person sits, real. That's when a person talks to themselves in the dead of the night, not engaging with other people. What are the psychological reasons for it? As I was writing my point number three, I was so happy that the Deputy Minister for Transport arrived, just as I was doing so. Because there's a question I've always asked when I was working for O.R. Tambo, you know, where a couple of years back. Why is it that our transport system is structured in such a manner that taxis in rural areas take people to town every day? That's about the only route. And then in the afternoon, they take people out of town. And because of the space in which I was working, very rural, and the running development programs there, I was saying how difficult it must be then for where councillors who have got no transport to meander, to touch all the various villages of their wards. If the transport system, I know it's driven by issues of economy, no taxi will want to veer on a route which is not going to give them, you know, money, you know, for the day, bread for the day. But I think our transport systems need to be, you know, needs to interrogate this as to how we can incentivize, Honorable Deputy Minister, be, you know, local public transport to move around a ward, which would enhance even the capacity of the ward councillors to be in touch with their citizens. Because as it is, it's practically impossible for someone who has got no car in rural areas to be in touch with their own. And in the process, if then in those critical spots, they could be could be created nodes, developmental nodes, which would have a pull effect. Because that's all that there is at the bottom of urbanization. People who live in the cities create a pull effect, whether you like it or not. If you want good prices, you'll find me in town. Whereas if we're to have, you know, development nodes scattered in the rural wards, you know, as a rural, well, I'll always be referring to rural wards, you know, then I think we would have this impact of making people to believe that they can have a good life in the rural areas. Land scarcity in the urban areas will continue to be a problem. And people will look up to government. So it's almost like a self-created problem if we don't stand up to slow down, if not prevent, the urbanization of the people. Take a medium, small city like Mthatha, all surrounded by land claims, the whole southern side of it. And as such, no development can progress in that because of land claims. And yet, there is land. But, you know, it's hindered by land claims. So a quick resolution, which would require a significant budget and conscious budget shift to do it. I don't think Honorable Nkwindi would be able to serve or to finalize, as they say, technically speaking, those land claims if it doesn't have an appropriate budget. It all speaks, Honorable Deputy Minister, to what you're talking about, coordinated planning. We continue to combat him in the committee as to why he's not finalizing the land claim. And he says, I don't have enough budget. There are so many other programs. So with urbanization, that's another challenge. There just isn't enough land for it. The cost of urban property is another prohibitive factor. Land claims, the physical scarcity of the land. What is going to be the effect of Sploma with the added problem that Sploma has yet to be located? That is the function. It's a mammoth and problem that needs immediate solution. We deliberated for about 30 minutes, this morning in the committee, this location of Sploma, and it still remains an unresolved problem. And I can tell you, Honorable Minister, it is having a huge impact. for two reasons. First, Sploma minimizes the importance of the role of the traditional leaders. And so you've got a whole segment of co-rulers who feel compromised by Sploma. That is their perception, whether that is the case or not. But they feel that they are no longer at the decision-making level. It's the councillors who decide, you know, on land use planning, because that's what this session is all about, fundamentally speaking, let alone the cooperative level, that's the administrative process. But fundamentally, it's all about land use planning. Now, if Sploma remains a controversial piece of legislation, we are not going to have, you know, the freedom to move about and implement, you know, where what fundamentally is holding back, you know, our moving, our being able to move forward. So that needs to be sorted out, locate Sploma, and then the appropriate department will have to deal with it, whether it's yourself, whether it's rural development, whether, or whatever it is. But that is one inhibiting factor. How can the problem of, you know, isolated planning be resolved? Which department is responsible for that? Department of Planning? Quite under deficit. Because indeed, out there, it is killing our progress. The fact that one department will go in there and plan and plan, and once they have left, like this typical case of the police station in Lusaka City, and there are many, many, I can tell you. When we were busy, you know, planning the Sasol garage, not far from Madiba's home, near, you know, Umchata. One big problem was that there was a clinic there which had not been used for something like 15 years, and we didn't have any land on which to position that clinic. But the owners of the land, public works, were running away. They were very busy with 20 care, wouldn't even come to meetings. And finally, when the right person who comes from Transkei was in the right position in public works, one meeting, after waiting for 3 years, I was personally involved in the process, one meeting, and she said, we're making this land available. And then we had that garage, simple as all that. And yet if there was contemplated planning, they would have had that garage long, long, long before. Towards the end, Chair, what relationship, this is a specific case, you may or may not feel comfortable to respond to this. There's 2.9 million hectares in KZN, which includes some cases, some cities, which is under the Ngonyama Trust. Now, when last we spoke to them in the committee, they said that they have got no relationship with local government. What is your relationship, from your understanding, between your department and the 2.9 million hectares of land under Ngonyama Trust? That is my bit. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Chair.
It wasn't a bit, it's a bite that you took, Honourable Member. The Honourable Sithole will be followed by the Honourable Dundra, and then the Honourable Mandela.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I just want to appreciate this informative input, and I want to plead with you, Chairperson Comrade Felix, that we have more of this, because this is an eye-opener. We usually want to ask questions that will have a meaning to the lives of our people, but we don't have the information. And I want to know if it is difficult for the minister or the department to make an arrangement with SABC so that you have a session, ongoing session, so that it must not only be members of parliament who understand what you are doing, but South Africans in general should be have an opportunity of understanding, because, you know, you have done so much, and me, being a member of parliament, I always looked at you as a group of very lazy people. And I didn't know what you were doing when you come in and out, you know. But I changed my mind today. But I want ordinary South Africans to change their minds like me. I heard you saying that there is a project that you are doing with the Swiss and the World Bank. And I want to know how much do you owe the World Bank. And I'll tell you what, I'm a student of development economics, and I've read a book by Professor Ha-Jung Chang of the Cambridge University, Kicking Away the Ladder. If you can go and read that book, you'll understand why I am asking you that question. The second one is, I am just wondering why departments never mention BRICS. BRICS, you always talk about World Bank, IMF. I'm not very much in love with those. I have read a book by Professor Joseph Stiglitz. He is talking about the BRICS as a very good project, not only for the BRICS country, but for the world, because he is arguing that the present institutions, the IMF and World Bank, do not have enough resources to actually promote the global development. So this is a very welcome initiative, but you don't seem to like it so much. You never mention it, not one department. Thank you.
The Honourable Dunjua.
No, thank you, Chair. In welcoming this informative and empowering presentation, I just want to check first on page 28. There's something that says the name there, Nyandeli. I just want to check, is it not Nyandeli? Not unless there is another town called Nyandeli, because that seems to be around the area of the Eastern Cape. There is a region called, the reason why it's called Nyandeli. I hope it's a correction. Secondly, I'm not going to be long, because some of the questions have been addressed. I'm just sitting here, as you are making a presentation, there is a department called Rural Development. Now, in this integrated urban development framework, I am, and I will be corrected, I'm not picking up what is it that the rural development has managed to do in terms of development. Not about land, to me, it's not about land claims only. That there are people who think that there is better life in PE, there is better life in Johannesburg, migrating from rural areas to Western stuff and whatever. When then we have got a department that is to be talking or dealing with issues of rural development. Or it is my understanding, not unless I'm naive, that department was created among other things to ensure that there is development in the rural areas that is not going to make people to migrate. Now, I'm getting a sense that we think that people are then going to move more into the urban area. What is it? Is there a possibility that maybe at the second round, I agree it must not be the only, at the second round, we get a picture of what is it? What have been the challenges of that department that makes it difficult for development in that area? Or how far are they with the development of the rural? So that we are able to understand and really know what is really disturbing. Because you see a number of people staying here in Sheikh because they think there's better life in this city, whereas in fact they come and suffer more. It was more on that in my view, Sheikh. Thank you very much.
The Honourable Mandela.
Thank you, Chair. Also, would like to appreciate the presentation put to us by Deputy Minister Andrew Snell. Quite thought-provoking, I think. Looking at slide number 23 here, I can't help but think that by 2050, 8 in 10 South Africans will live in urban areas. I'm a rural boy like Obao Dlamini over the Honorable Philton, come from a tiny precinct in Mvezo, which is located on the banks of Mbashe River in Mthatha. It bothers me, looking at this figure, 8 out of 10 South Africans will be living in urban areas. What we understand by that urban area, is Dutywa an urban area? Is Enobo an urban area? Is Kosimbaba an urban area? Umbu, Olo, I can go on. Because then I want to understand where am I placed in this? Where are people of my constituency based in this urban area? Since post-1994 to date, how much have we actually done in terms of spatial planning to look into these areas like Dutywa, to look into areas like Ovimba, and ensure that spatial planning helps to keep our people within rural communities. But then also look at the Department of Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs. What have we done in terms of spatial planning with traditional leaders? I couldn't help but look at the video that was tracing development of cities around the world. And I looked keenly if I would see Mambukube there or Zimbabwe there, as in that small ruins in Zimbabwe. And I couldn't see the first Bulawayo. You know, we speak of Bulawayo today in Zimbabwe and forget that the first Bulawayo was here during the time of Shaka in KwaZulu-Natal. And I can't help but want to understand, in terms of the development of these rural areas, where I'm certain that Africans bound by tradition will never abandon place of their forefathers where their graves lie. No matter, they can go to Rustenburg and work in the mines, they can go to Johannesburg and work in factories, but when the time of being a migrant laborer expires, they head straight back home and they want to be buried in their place of origin. So I would really want to understand, what are we looking to do in terms of spatial planning in those rural areas? Or are we so in sync with the urbanization that we see urbanization in the terms of Johannesburg, Cape Town, Durban, and we forget that there are those small, tiny villages like Tsom, which are considered to be a small town. But on slide 70, Honorable Chair, it speaks about the Swiss State Secretariat for Economic Affairs, which is granted and managed by the World Bank, the support in that regard. Perhaps let me deviate from that and ask in terms of the BRICS Bank, which we have been part of. What is it doing in terms of support in these intermediate cities we are envisioning, and the role that the BRICS Bank will be playing in ensuring that our small village towns grow to be cities? Thank you.
I've seen another hand at the back there, the good doctor, the veteran.
Thank you, our chair. Whatever we are talking about here needs resources. And without resources, we can't even talk about it. We just say the trend is urbanization. I think in a few years' time, we may be having 2 mega cities in South Africa. And that needs resources, both financial and land. And the population is increasing. We need to feed them. and we are not preparing for this, I don't see us frantically opening agricultural colleges which will teach our children to grow food to feed the people who are increasing at an exponential rate. And two, we have resources that we are actually squandering, as though there is no tomorrow. We have minerals, and these minerals are being captured by non-South Africans, and we are not doing anything about it. When there is no minerals, we will be needing them to actually improve the lives of our people. We still talk about going to beneficiate our minerals in future. And in future, there will be half of minerals are wasting commodities. They don't increase. Once all the iron ore is shipped from Sishen to Europe and beneficiated, what are we going to beneficiate in future, and what are we benefiting out of it? I just heard that, or learned that the government of the DRC decided to agree with the Chinese that for their infrastructure development plan, in exchange for minerals, the minerals must be beneficiated so that they have more value, and and instead of just shipping them raw as they are and keeping on shipping them, but at the same time paying for that infrastructure. That means paying maybe four times what the infrastructure is worth with their minerals. So if they say, okay, you give you minerals, but you must beneficiate these minerals and pay us enough. Because just now we are giving people land and say land restitution. Meanwhile, we are going to need land to use for feeding the very same people when they have increased in number and built houses for them, shelter for them, and give them water. Western Cape hasn't got water now. It's not that we didn't know that this is going to happen, but we did nothing about it. Right? So what happens if you are going to have to do the same thing with one village there, another one there, and another one there? It's a nightmare. What is development? Does development mean that building people houses, and so on and so on? I think we have to develop the developers first, make it a jihad or at least a holy war to develop the developers of the future first. Those are the ones who are going to develop the country and the land. But we are entering into a fourth industrial revolution, which is high tech. But we haven't got a single university that's devoted entirely for technology. We seem to think that education is a favor for the rich who can afford it. The rest, we just shepherd them through the system, and at the end they have no use value. That education of theirs is no use value. Hence we have thousands and thousands of graduates who are of no use value to the system. But we put them through that, and we pay a lot of money and say that, well, they are poor. And what do? We don't say, 1, 2, 3, 4, you are going to do this. We are going to pay for it. You are going to do for it. When you come back, this is what you are going to do. No. If we allow people to have choice, they can choose to be cooks. What are they going to cook when there is no food on the table? We don't have farmers to grow the food, but they do cooking or whatever, cookery studies at the university level. What are they going to cook? We must sit down and be specifically brutal and say, this is what we want we are going to do, and this is what we are going to do, and have, enforce it and do it. And long-term 50-year plan, not just 2 years, 3 years. NDP is a very good project. What are we going to actually operationalize it with? It needs lots of resources. It needs a lot of practitioners. But we are not thinking about producing cogent courses which the practitioners will come and will use the IDP to develop our country. Right? If we don't have water, people will migrate. They'll run away and go to places where there is water. So what do we do? How do we bring water? There is lots of water in the sea here. And technology these days desalinates water very cheaply. In fact, in the process of desalinating water, you actually did generate enough electricity out of the water itself. So why don't we make a technology university which deals with water and get children in there and capacitate them to come and deal with that aspect of water. Open the rural area, open agricultural colleges, and the land that we are giving away as restitution, keep it for agricultural purposes, to grow food for everybody, because we are going to have to buy it in future from the very people to whom we are allocating it now. They cannot develop it, they don't have the wherewithal, and in future they are going to sell it to the government at high prices. That is when you do something in order to gain more money out of it. We are nearly planning in a very unrational manner, let's put it that way, for the lack of better ways. It's what we call a thinking in a very wrong way, because what we are doing is just going to be a burden to us in future, big time. And we have all people from Africa coming to Joburg or to South Africa. They don't come with oodles of money to come and industrialize. We build a lot of houses for people, but we don't build factories for them to work and afford those houses. So it is free, but it's going to be very costly in future when we don't even have the resources anymore to cope with this. So let us sit down and restart planning and enforcing this plan for 20, 50 years plan and so on. And make sure our resources are shepherded so well that we are jealous of them. We don't give them away just cheaply for anybody. We have to learn to save and make sure that out of our savings, we develop our resources and our people. The World Bank and IMF have never developed any country, especially the so-called developing countries. That's why Africa is underdeveloped, and is underdeveloped by the conditionalities of this world financial institution. Why can't we have our own resources, save from them, and develop our people? Thank you.
And the Honourable Kobaza.
Thank you, Chairperson. I struggled, Chairperson, to understand that in the light of this migration into the cities, what is going to be the future of food security? What's going to be the future of commercial agriculture? Because clearly, it's the younger people who are getting into the cities. Those who are engaged in agriculture now are aging, and we are not in any way trying to attract the younger people to stay in the rural areas and be skilled
in agriculture, precisely because we should be conscious of sustained food availability, even for those who are migrating into the urban centers. Linked to that is the fact that industrialization is not happening at the same rate as urbanization. So people are moving into the towns in search of better economic opportunities, but there is no growth in industrialization that would accommodate this hunger for economic activity and economic opportunity. And therefore, we are creating a problem for ourselves if we allow this to happen without us thinking about how do we develop the rural areas in a manner that keeps that create them into economically viable areas. That therefore takes me to the issue of, for instance, the role of land, of rural development and land reform, and agriculture, forestry, and fisheries. What role are they playing consciously? You know, there is a difference between just, you know, keeping existing agriculture going and issue of restitution of land being addressed, and consciously developing agriculture and expanding it. And resourcing these developments so that we don't allow this migration to happen because people are searching for opportunities in the cities where there is no expansion of such opportunities. Chair, lastly, there's an interesting development happening in our country. Perhaps, and I don't know about other countries, if you drive along the countryside in the rural areas, people are building big houses out there. And of course, there's a challenge of water access in those big houses that I imagine. I'm not sure whether it is the old retired people leaving the cities back to the rural areas, or it is young working people who are seeing the value of building their residential homes back in their rural areas, possibly because also to them commuting between those rural areas and the places of work in town is easy, or it's both. We need to look into that. Because what it says to me, it re-emphasizes the point that we really need to, in our, Nkosi Mandela talked about land. We really need to talk about how do we plan such that these own initiatives are recognized and encouraged. Because it does two things. It eases the pressure on governments to provide accommodation in the city. But at the same time, it encourages people to consider staying in the rural areas and developing rural areas as economic viable places. It takes me to the issue the good doctor was raising now. I don't know whether, for instance, we are exploring the existing minerals in the rural areas and considering in future, you know, mining, developing mining in those areas, the green fields and so on and so on. The stock of shale gas in the Karoo, and then Karoo, which is a very dry area, by the way, and very rural, but there is very slow development towards really finalizing those issues so that you create those opportunities in those areas and so on. And of course, the whole issue of various ways of harvesting water in the rural areas to make it possible for the economy in the rural areas to grow and make it possible for people to stay. When we develop the special economic zones, but we don't develop the resources such as water, and we are slow in developing transport networks in the rural areas, it's not going to fly. And it's going to force people to then do exactly what we are being presented here with. Thank you, Chairperson.
The Honourable Member at the back.
Thank you very much. Some of the information that I was going to share has been exhausted so far. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to talk about one critical issue. I mean, we are talking about integrated urban development framework, and honestly speaking, it versus degrading views that our eyes cannot avoid to see, nor to catch. When you drive towards the airport, on your right hand side, you see a degrading view of Langa, which we cannot obviously avoid. And that also needs to be taken into consideration, because it's in between industrialized area and what we call semi or urban areas. So what I want to ask is, what is in your plan through this development of reducing that disaster looking risky type of an area? Can it all not be included in the program itself? I know that a choice has been made of cities that need to be developed, but there are areas as we enter cities that are not definitely looking good, and they are part and parcel of our country. Thank you.
Honourable Deputy Minister.
Pastor, thank you very, very much, and thank you very much to all of the members who have raised issues. I think for us that just underscores the point that the issue of urbanization and the issue of dealing with the legacy of apartheid spatial patterns is something that affects all of our committees. And I think the breadth of the inputs, ranging from land to transport to the interface between councils and traditional leaders, to issues of minerals and beneficiation, industrial policy, issues of the interface between urban development and rural development, indicate indeed this is an all of government and all of society issue. I'm going to propose that we deal with the questions in the following manner. I will open just by addressing very quickly the issue of urban and rural and saying one or two things about BRICS, then give Deputy Minister Chikunga a chance to address specifically the transport issues, but also any other issues that she feels she would want to address. Then Deputy Minister Masuku, maybe specifically touching upon the issues of industrial policy, minerals, beneficiation, fourth industrial revolution, but also the land question, and again, anything else that you feel you would want to address. And then we give to DDG Themba Fosi and Dr. Olver the chance to maybe to speak specifically about the program, say more about the Swiss Bank, the Swiss Development Agency, the World Bank, also address the issue of Spluma, the migration of Spluma, and then some, I think especially the last question about Langa and other specific areas that have been raised. And then we'll also give Mr. Stolingbanga a chance also to speak from the city network side if he chooses. Chair, I think just the issue of urban development and rural development for us is absolutely crucial to this whole thing, because we can't, I think it's very correct, I mean, it's very important to pose the question in a correct manner. And I think by talking about urban versus rural is starting off on a wrong foot. I mean, firstly, what we try to show in our presentation, and maybe the good doctor could also come to our rescue here, is that in a sense, many of the things that we're talking about are not, they're not things that individuals decide. We're talking here, and I'm sure that the good doctor would use the language of dialectical and historical materialism. I mean, these are very deep-seated processes that are driven by the nature that the world is developing. So you would see on that video clip that at a particular juncture in the history of the world, maybe from the 1700s, 1800s onwards, when Europe was going through an industrial revolution, there was a particular type of urbanization that took place in certain parts of the world. And indeed, it was linked to industrialization. You had a program of so-called closing the commons, where people in rural areas were literally excluded and driven off the land and driven into the cities to go and work in the cotton mills and whatever. You would have also seen in that video clip how the rise of industrialization in Europe was linked to the expansion of colonialism in other parts of the world. And that colonialism, I mean, in South Africa, took on a particular form. And that colonialism was exactly meant also to feed the process of industrialization and the linked process of urbanization in Europe with raw materials. What made it possible for South Africa to feed into that process of European industrialization and it was the mining sector, it was the concomitant migrant labor system, it was forced removals, it was the pass laws, influx control. So when we talk about urbanization in a South African context, we must discuss it within that historical, we can't be ahistorical in our understanding of urbanization in a South African context. If you appreciate that history, first you would appreciate that because of a migrant labor system, migratory patterns in South Africa are not unidirectional. You're dealing of necessity with circular migration patterns. You're dealing with people who might be working in one part of the country but maintaining a family in another, well, having a family, working and having a family in one part of the country and living and having a family in another part of the country as well. So those interlinkages already between the rural and the urban are very strong, and they assume certain characteristics of our history. So again, just to talk about those things as if they were divorced, I think gets us off on a wrong foot immediately. So For us, the perspective adopted by the IUDF is not how do we keep people, how do we slow down urbanization. The issue is that in many, as we also showed in some of the slides, it's not so much necessarily people coming from rural areas to big metros. Yes, that's happening, and it's happening on a massive scale, and we've got to deal with it. But equally, it's your so-called rural areas, and this links to the Honourable Mandela's question, those rural areas themselves or urbanizing. There's an American progressive geographer urbanist called Mike Davis. He says it's not just the peasant that's coming to the city, but the city is coming to the peasant. And indeed, that is what we're dealing with in a South African context. All of those areas, Honorable Mandela, that you mentioned, Duchwa, Kofimbaba, those areas, we would regard those as urban areas and that need to be dealt with in the context of the integrated urban development framework. The reality is that you need strong urban areas for rural areas to be successful, and you need strong rural areas for urban areas to be successful. If you look at the agricultural value chain, a big part of that value chain passes through urban areas. If you don't have viable urban areas that can, from the point of view of the finances required for agriculture and other aspects of economic activity in rural areas, can't support that. If you don't have the places in urban areas to support and maintain the machinery that you need for agriculture, if you don't have places in your urban areas where you do, and by urban I don't mean the metro, I mean those urban areas, those urban settlements within broader rural areas where you can do agro-processing, where you've got markets. If you don't do those things in a linked way, you undermine both. So I think just to say, I mean, in response to the Honorable Sultani and others, I think let us look at how we develop urban and rural areas in tandem, not promoting rural development as a break, because I think that the very first video clip that we showed, I think just indicates that, you know, to try and think that you are going to stop or turn around the overall trend of urbanization is really, I think it's a very misguided endeavor. Maybe just to say about BRICS, I think we very deliberately in the presentation included the quotes from China, and we underlined the fact that it is a fellow BRICS country. Certainly we have very, very strong links. There is a BRICS urbanization forum that meets on an annual basis. South Africa will be hosting the BRICS urbanization forum next year. We hosted it, what was it, I think about 4 years ago, in Itigwini. BRICS Urbanization Forum brings together governments, but also academics, researchers, local governments from all the BRICS countries in a forum to share experience of knowledge around urbanization. We, as COCTA, we've been very, very active in pursuing collaboration with the Chinese. About 3 months ago, we were in Beijing. We were meeting with the Chinese Ministry for Human Settlements, Urban Rural Development and Infrastructure, also with the Chinese Academy for Urban Planning and Design, and looking at how we can strike partnerships. So we are very, very committed to dealing with urbanization in the BRICS context. And I mean, if you just look at the BRICS countries, those are all countries that either have very high rates, high levels of urbanization. Countries like Brazil has urban rates of in the 80, if not 90%. China still has a comparatively low percentage, but the numbers are huge, and they're consciously accelerating that. India, still probably the lowest percentage of all the BRICS countries. I think it's around in the 30s. But again, very consciously pushing it. And then South Africa, a fairly high percentage. We also find that partnership very useful because in countries, especially Brazil and India, many of the urban challenges that they face are very, very similar to our own. So just to assure the members that now we are very committed to BRICS. Deputy Minister Chikunga.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. Honourable members, definitely apologize for arriving late. I'm from Pretoria. We have an international conference which went to open in the morning. On issues related to transport, Honourable Sitan, FES would not be talking about this in the past because people would be transported from their areas to the city, back to the city, to their areas. But because of what Honourable Andrew Nell is saying, SDM Nell is saying, that you have urbanization happening even in the rural areas now, smaller inner cities and all this, then the need is arising. And what this document is actually saying to us is that we cannot therefore be taken by surprise. And that is why we need to blame all of us together in an integrated way. So that when human settlements decide to build houses in an area X, because urbanization, when you talk about 8 in 10 by whatever time, it's not like it's going to happen just in 2050. It is already happening. And that is why the statistics are saying today there are more people in Gauteng than in KZN. Yet all the time KZN has been leading. Now it has changed because of urbanization. And we cannot therefore be taken by surprise. We need to plan for it. Plan transport as we have here, because there will be any for transport that circulates within the areas where people are, because there surely must be economic activities that are taking place. In the past, they used not to be such, so it will definitely be there. We do have, if I was just to mention, say, we do have intertaxes that are actually doing that in case that and we have what they call a Makela, for instance, that's now circulating. The issue is regulating that and ensuring that it is formal transport that is transporting people like that. There was also a question on related to skills, to say by the honourable member to say we're not training people, and I agree, probably not doing enough. But maybe we might also have to brief honourable members on what we are doing. For instance, at the Department of Transport, we talk of not anything less than 804 just this year of people that we are consciously trained on transport-related careers. Those that we believe will be absorbed. If you, for instance, go to the University of Northwest, we have, if you like, a faculty, which we, as the Department of Transport, are funding. Initially, they were trained, we said train them on transport logistics and management. But we now have said, please introduce transport engineers, because that's what we need within the transport. And they are doing it for us. We have MOUs with other universities. So yes, we are trying to do this. It could be that we're not communicating. It could be that it is at a smaller scale. We don't know. We can't, for instance, transform aviation without training aviators, whether they be in the form of air traffic controllers or air traffic controllers or pilots or technicians and so on. We're doing it here in South Africa, and we are funding that as government. If your child is taken for air traffic navigation training, for instance, we pay them as government. So it doesn't matter whether they come from poor families. We're doing it because that's what we need for now as a department. But we might not be talking about it. So yes, there is something that we do, which we learn from our organization, from our leaders, such as O.R. Tambo, who send people, who many are here for training and in preparation for taking over as government. We are trying, we might not be doing at the scale that we think is necessary. I think I just wanted to respond to that question. For me, the important issue is integrated planning. If human settlement says we're going to build houses, for them to even go to the area and inspect, they need transport, they need road. For them to build and have people there settling, they need the school, they need the clinic, they need the land. And therefore that integration is necessary in preparation, but also in a way of saying we know for sure that urbanization is going to happen. Is happening. It's not like it is going to happen in future. It's happening now. Statistics are proving to us that. How ready are we to deal with that situation so that we do not end up with urban areas that are full of people that we've not planned for, people that are committing crime, people that do not know what to do, that do not have, I mean, houses and so on. How do we deal, plan for that in South Africa? I think it is important. Good as we still ensure that the very rural areas, as probably rural areas, as we probably find them, continue to be developed. I think that is very important. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. I think that if it was a question of urbanization coming out of just one system of movement from one area to the other, somehow, interestingly, it will be better to handle, because if you take, say, an area like Bushbuck Ridge, as it has been mentioned there, if you were to have migration of people moving out of Bushbuck Ridge to another area, it would create a new opportunity of you expanding the Kruger National Park, expanding the forestry side on one side, and also in the middle, getting your agriculture to grow. But it's not like that. So you have migration, like Deputy Minister Nel was saying. At the same time, we have for those areas themselves urbanizing in themselves. So you find those areas becoming now urbanizing small towns, and they begin to look for needs that are more urban than your rural. So the key of this presentation, it is forcing us to say, can we be more disciplined and more focused in terms of how we need to handle this development? And one of the things from the economic side that we normally do is that we are now engaging at the local level. One of the questions that we're asking when you go there, we say, in this municipality, say we go to Bushbuck, we ask them, so in which municipality, what are your intentions in the next 10 to 20 years? How do you visualize this municipality to be like? So what we're beginning to ask those questions are saying that if you have got to come up with an economic development, you can't talk about it away from a responsibility to create a sustainable ecology, ecological relationships between your resources. So human resource, your resources, you can't even talk development if you don't talk about your land resources, your mineral resources, your human resources, your air resources. All those you have to, and the water resources, all those are the ones that if you want to create a development, you are supposed to look at how they relate all of them. And you should be able to take it from that angle. So if you have got that kind of a discipline, it means that that is why if you look at the programs that are going on in terms of what must be done, the question about base to basic becomes very critical, because it means that your capacity at a local level must actually be so strong to be able to analyze the environment and be able to identify this, how you want to make use of that. The challenge that we're going to be having currently in terms of our rural areas is that hasn't been reflected in our areas. There's been reflected, all activities have tended to happen on their own. And if there's one thing that we must arrest is to allow them to happen on their own, because these are the ones that are creating the distortions. You start having human beings starting to pack themselves in a particular area that is not sustainable, no space for your economic development, no space for grazing, no space for recreation, no space where you can actually put in other amenities. So the back to basics become very key, because you can talk about any development and outside it. So when we talk about also the issue around economic development and industrialization, it's not industrialization that is going to be imported into an area. It is going to it's industrialization and then economic development that is going to be happening there and attract other interests to come in there. So that's what you are actually focusing on now. But what is it that we are doing? We are saying we are advocating for this very disciplined, focused planning and systematic allocation of resources in a manner that will assist us to make changes into the country. That's the limitation of this. Because when we don't do that, what is it that then distracts us? Is what the doctor was saying, that if you've got that, then you're going to have a long-term planning vision, and then which is going to be executed in pieces. But if you don't have that, why does that happen? We have got a 5-year term. In that 5-year term. So you start chasing numbers in terms of what you must deliver. So if you are in housing, you start looking at numbers of how many houses have I done. And if you are in another area, in schools, you are going to look at how many schools that you have done without looking at the relationship between these two. So if you then force ourselves to be disciplined and plan in an integrated manner, is the one that is going to say to us, where do we tackle this problem from? From which angle? How do we start? How do we employ these resources in such a way that they bring about change? Just in closing, if you look at China as an example, in 2000 and before 2007, the issue about rural and urban wasn't so much strong because they had a program in terms of industrialization and too much focus in the urban. They then realized that it just became natural that they started having a lot of problems even in the urban areas. They had a lot of people, rural poverty coming in a midst of a bigger development. In 2007, when we were interacting with them, they started saying, can you help us? We see that there are doing certain things there in South Africa. Yes, we are trying to do certain things, but we are not sure if we are going to be able to handle that. Then they started emphasizing now, coming up with a program to respond more positively, not just reactive, but more positively, coming with a comprehensive program that says, how do we deal with this urbanization, urban migration of young people, because they have defined it. They said you have young people who want these innovations and all these things that they want to go into the urban centers and do more work. But at the same time, you want also rural development that will give you the food and all these things that the cities want from you. So they then put in two programs and say, if there are people that want to migrate and they want to do some things in an urban area, we need to put in a program where we resource them and we incentivize them to say that if you move from a rural area and want to go and stay in town, here is your subsidy. We are giving you money to go and stay in town. But as you go and stay in town, you're going to subsidize someone to use this in order to have development. So you see that the development becomes both sides in terms of urbanization, in terms of migration into the cities, and also an intervention that has got to do with also your people at that local level. And the other thing that they actually implemented, which lessons from, is that as they do that, they also look at what are the industrialization strategies that suit this environment.
creating a special development for that particular area. So we can't do that before we discipline ourselves using, this framework. We run all over. You find rural development waking up in the morning, become happy because we have started rural development there and another rural development there, but we can't get it together and say what impact has it made collectively as a country. So it's those things that the executive is trying to actually deal with so that we are all focusing in that particular. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. The question on the Swiss, maybe let me start with the World Bank. We don't have any sort of, we've not taken any loan from the World Bank. As part of the donor support programs of the different countries, so there'll be country-to-country agreement where European Union or the USAID and all these different GIZ, all these different countries would agree with South Africa in terms of the areas of support. And then the form of that support will take different forms in terms of the instruments that they use. In this case, the Swiss, it's part of the country-to-country agreement in terms of the support to South Africa, particularly focusing on urban development. But the instrument that they are using is to channel their resources through the World Bank offices that are based here in South Africa. So that's the nature of the support that you are receiving. But in terms of the programs, we are determining the focus areas and actually shaping the actual implementation of that. But we're benefiting from that support from the Swiss. But we don't have a direct relationship with the World Bank. And then there are many other donors that we're working with as part of supporting COPTA. Chair, there's also a question on Sploma, the shift. Maybe just to provide the context, you have the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, where the National Development Plan is housed, and the implementation of the National Development Plan. They are currently looking at mechanisms of how you institutionalize planning, monitoring and evaluation as part of ensuring that as a country, you have a cohesive state actions around implementation of that plan. So the key departments that are in discussions in terms of the shift of SPLOM, which is a special planning instrument, is DPME. COCTA, because we are responsible for municipal planning in terms of the Municipal Systems Act. But of course, the Department of Rural Development will still be central in terms of that function. But so it will be these three departments that will be responsible. But we are currently in discussion in terms of how that process will be undertaken and deciding on issues of roles and responsibilities and the form of in terms of the expression legally of that, how we coordinate that special planning. But critical to the issue of special planning and then our commitment to reversing the legacies of apartheid special patterns, it requires stronger forms of collaboration and partnerships. So it's not just an issue of the issue of the role of traditional leaders and councillors, but you need to look at the roles of all the critical stakeholders in that space. So traditional leaders are critical in terms of issues of land ownership and how they partner with municipalities in terms of access or releasing land for development. But also the role of private sector is also critical in terms of vision. So it's important that in the context of in a municipal space, that all the critical sort of stakeholders in that space are able to look at how they form the stronger forms of collaboration and partner around pursuing these spatial transformation outcomes in that space, which involves all these different players. I think the critical to the issue of implementation of the MDP and pursuing our objective of addressing poverty, unemployment, and inequality planning, as the Deputy Ministers have indicated. Because we have a three-tier system of government, it's important to have a cohesive plan. So issues of integrated planning and coherent implementation is at the center of this, appreciating that we have three levels of government. But the reality is that municipalities remain the only space where all these other two spheres implement. And that you won't achieve that if you have fragmentation and uncoordinated action. So at the center then of also the IUDF, is how we introduce a new discipline in how the three spheres plan together, implement, budget together, but also implement together in an integrated way, in targeted specific areas. And I think if the success of the IUDF, it will be how the three spheres work together in achieving particular outcomes in targeted spaces.
I would like to hear the voice of Dr. Oliver. The last time I interacted with him was in a certain metropolitan area in the country, in a certain building on the fourth or fifth floor, where we dealt with the other issues impacting on all
on,
these
on urban development,
on urban development and transformation.
Well, Chair, I think I'm largely covered by Mr. Forsey's reply, but maybe just to say it's pleasure to be here in front of this house, and I've recently started on this work as the program manager for the IUDF. It's a challenging job, which I'm enjoying, and I look forward to further opportunities to engage on this. Mr. Setola Mbanga is going to talk a little bit from the SACN's perspective.
Thanks very much, Chair. Chair, at the risk of repeating some of the things that have been mentioned, I would like to deal very specifically with the question, I think put differently, but I think ultimately what the question is asking is, what is driving urbanization? And when the then Department of Provincial and Local Government, now COCTA, alongside SALGA, and the large cities created the cities network, that was at the center of the question. And I'm not going to answer or provide answers to all those questions, but here are some of the issues that we have picked up that are driving urbanization. The first one is technology. And I will perhaps just utilize transport. 100 years ago, vehicles used to be driving at a particular pace. So between distances, they will take X number of days. In the intermediacy between traveling between one point and the other, there will be stops, and towns will form. Today you have aeroplanes. They take 1 hour. Those towns that used to be in the intermediate between two points are dying. What does that do? It leads to people leaving those towns to go and settle somewhere. That's reason number one. So technology, and I've just utilized transport. The second reason is that human beings are generally anthropological. That means they move. It's their nature. They were born to move. They're not going to stay in one place because I was born in Sinza. My parents grew up in Sinza, and I studied in Tsofimvaba. That's not going to happen because by nature, I'm an anthropological being. But thirdly, there's this thing that we have introduced in the country called democracy. What democracy is doing is that it is fueling the insatiable desire for people to develop. So if I was born in Sinzana, well, during apartheid, I would have wanted to study at UNITRA. But post-apartheid, possibly, I do not want to study at UNITRA because the doors have opened. So democracy has allowed certain things to happen. Now, I'm just using those three examples to say South Africa is not facing urbanization as such, if we were to be academic and be research-oriented. Chairman said about it. South Africa is possibly facing massive deruralization because the bulk of South Africans come from rural areas. But I suspect what we've done in the policy and research space is to look at this phenomena with global spectacles, and hence we easily got trapped into calling it urbanization, when in fact, perhaps what we should have called it was deruralization. So, and I think, as the Deputy Minister says, if we had looked at it from a deruralization point of view, perhaps we would be speaking a different language. But ultimately, we will be wanting the same outcomes as a result of our intervention. So what is the Deputy Minister now crying out for through COPTA and the built environment sector units? And therefore, what is the IUDF trying to do? Firstly, I think what the IUDF is trying to do, Chair, and it's trying to help the House to understand, is that we need to speak a very simple language. The type of language which he calls all of government and all of society. In other words, the type of language that not only government understands, but also the private sector understands. Because in as much as we are interventionists through IDPs and the like, as he correctly says, the private sector is busy doing something else on the other side. So we're busy spending money, putting RDP houses and middle-income houses, but the private sector is building something else. And the human being what the human being is, goes where choice is provided. And unfortunately, that choice has a lot of class orientation in it, and there's politics that are involved in this. Secondly, what I think in simple terms the IUDF is wanting us to do is to get us into action, almost in more or less the same way that, if this is a correct example to make, the big document that says we will host the World Cup 2010 asked us to do. It was a single document. It said South Africa will do A, B, C, which is what the IUDF leaders, as I said, are articulating. And those A, B, C were done to meet a particular framework. So we can't continue having the types of townships that were created as a consequence of moving people from Cape Town to Ciskei and still having Tanzania 20 years down the line looking like it is. So, and I think that's what the IUDF is seeking to do. It's saying there has to be a time frame within which all of our coordinated efforts work. And perhaps lastly, besides galvanizing resources towards one single point, it's also potentially saying, let's connect the dots. When one woman gets raped, it's not because they just chose to be raped. It is because there are living conditions that were created. Remember, townships, if I may use the example, were created as dormitories, not as spaces of production. So when social ills play themselves, either in Cape Town or in Danzan or Kailicha or wherever else, well, the Premier of Western Cape now has started to take some of our studies that we've done in preparation for the IUDF to start to respond to what she calls urban safety. And I think what we're saying is that you can't have one geography in South Africa responding, if that response is good anyway. But you can't have one geography responding and the others not responding to something, to things that that we are all seeing. Thanks,
Chair. No, thank you very much for those responses and for the presentation as well. You could hear from the questions and the inputs of members of Parliament not only the interest but also the importance of this integrated planning to take place. The Deputy Minister in the presentation correctly grounded the presentation in terms of the international development frameworks and our commitments in terms of the SDGs, also the outcomes of the UN New Urban Agenda of 2036, the African Union Agenda 2063, and then of course our own Vision 2030, the National Development Plan. And what is quite striking in this presentation is the issue of complementarity of how we complement each other. It's not the one is not at the expense of the other. And especially the slide that says it's rural and urban, not urban versus rural, right? And that's important for our development because ultimately when we approach development in that way, the outcome will not only be the commitment in terms of functionally integrated, balanced and vibrant urban settlements only, will also be busy creating smart urban areas that function at an optimum for the benefit of our people to address the inequality that exists. There was also mention made, of course, of how do we take as committees this process forward, and we undertake, and there won't be any opposition as far as the members of parliament are concerned who are here or not here, that we work with the relevant staff from the departments of bringing the staff of parliament that support committees. And what I would like to see, honourable members and deputy ministers, is almost providing a small toolkit for members of parliament serving in different portfolio committees that they can have available. At the time, honourable Sitole, when departments come again at the beginning of the year, and after the budget has been tabled, so that we can look what is the strategic plan, right? Because that is where it really starts. What is the strategic plan? Where are these different elements infused into the plan of the department, the budgeting, the line function, or the line items on the budget, and then ultimately to assess through our BRRR process whether we are moving in that direction or not, and then to hold departments accountable when they come to present their annual reports. And that is not a one-year cycle process, it's an ongoing process in the lifespan of a parliament. And we will thus, honourable members, take up the invitation and the opportunity that this presents to also create more forums inside parliament to further interrogate this, develop that toolkit that we said is there, and then see how the different portfolio committees take up the challenge to the different departments in terms of delivering on these commitments. Not that we've only made to these different international bodies that the government subscribed to, but also to implementing and challenging the massive levels of inequality. Still, you can see it on a daily basis, the spatial patterns of apartheid still in your face all the time. How dormant pieces of land that was used to divide the different population groups in South Africa from one another is now exploited by the private sector at their own whim. And that doesn't necessarily address the inequalities that is there, but it creates actually new centers that further divides our people from one another. So this is crucial to the work that members will be doing. I want to thank the deputy ministers who are here, Deputy Minister Nell, Deputy Minister Shipunga, Deputy Minister Masuku, as well as the Honourable Minister of Labour, Amanda Olifant, that was here earlier, for their presence, as well as the staff and officials that supported or is supporting them in this important work. Honourable members, thank you very much for your presence, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.